This service, unlike many others I have created in previous summers, will be in our humanist tradition. It will be in the form of an intellectual dissertation to challenge your mind and hopefully change your consciousness and perspective to one of greater gratitude and appreciation for our great nation. There will be pauses for music and contemplation and a reading from one of our founding documents. My goal is to convey three broad notions. One notion is that anti-Americanism is really tied to the deeper issue of the individual and his relationship to society and the world, and has its roots in millennia before America's founding. That three-fourths of the planet's dominant religious cultures is foreign to the notion of the development of the individual as we have here in the United States. That the very fundamental premises of the Declaration of Independence, of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are entirely absent and cannot be considered by these cultures as self-evident truths, which lead us to a great misunderstanding, which has its roots in a reality that is not shared. The second thesis is that many of the criticisms about American culture, particularly its capitalism, are tied to an ignorance of the five branches of philosophy, and that there is, in fact, an integrated, coherent, rational, philosophical system that does, in fact, exist underlying the American culture and our governing documents. The third thesis will be that there are grave consequences in abandoning our Constitution and our culture of individual responsibility and freedom in favor of a culture of European intellectual coercive paternalism and cradle-to-grave social welfare. The USA will fail, as Europe is failing, but much faster unless we compromise the progressive ideologies toward those of autonomy, freedom, and our founding principles that include freedom, federalism, and individual rights and their responsibilities. Perhaps you could say this is my defense of my love of this country and my intellectual defense against some of the harshest criticisms that some of you may harbor. This reading is an excerpt from a lecture by Joseph Campbell on symbolism in the individual. The point I want to try to make today is the contrast between Orient and Occidental concepts of the problems of the individual. My principal approach is to draw here are that the ideals of the West for the individual and individual freedom and so forth have no meaning at all in the traditional Oriental world and have got to be renewed in our thinking in reference toward ideals for the Western world. On the other hand, to stress the fact that progress for the West, I mean, this is the ideal and is what we represent and what we have to contribute to humanity in the way of a spiritual image. I draw the main division between Orient and Occident in terms of the mythological and traditional symbols in Iran and Persia. This is the watershed. Eastward of Iran, we have two great domains. We have India and its world, and the domain of the Far East, principally China and Japan. Westward domain, we have divisions also, the division of the Levant, the Near East, and the division of Europe. And these four domains, in the history of their symbolic traditions, are quite distinct in style, quite distinct in ideas. However, they do group into two orders of two, Indian and China on the one hand, the Levant and Europe on the other. These two great fields represent, in earlier days, dialogues between each of its divisions, India and the Far East in dialogue, and the Levant in Europe. The great extraordinary thing that has happened in the contemporary world is that these two quite different spheres of humanity have been brought together and now are trying to speak to each other intelligently so that they should understand each other and be able to live, so to say, in symphony or in counterpoint, need not any one overpowering the other. Since what we really need is this multiple discourse. The extraordinary thing to consider is that all four have sprung finally from one single root. Every one of these civilizations is based ultimately on the arts of agriculture and the domestication of cattle. In earlier primitive societies, which are small, every individual controls the entire cultural inheritance. You have in the small hunting community a total human being. Normal divisions are in terms of sex and age groups. But every man, every woman, and even every youngster controls what is necessary to control in order to be a total member of that society. However, with the emergence of the larger communities based on the arts of agriculture, which begin to appear around 5000 BC, by 4500 BC, there's a whole constellation of substantial villages in the Near East, and by 3500 BC, they have begun to be rather large cities. It is at this time that a differentiation in the society begins. They are specialists. They are craftsmen with specializations. They are priest castes. There are governing castes, and there are serving castes. You get a differentiation of the society. And the adult now is no longer in total control of the entire cultural good. He is part man. And what you see in the symbolism of this period, the interest in trying to conceive of the relationship of part to whole. In the art of 4500 BC Samarra, you see beautifully organized fields with disparate elements gathered so that they relate to a whole. And on the center of these designs, there is always a symbolic or symbol that indicates the integrating principle. And this form in later symbology is in the form of a god. It is the symbol of a deity. The deity becomes the superordinated principle to which everyone is ordinate, is coordinated. And this deity is incarnate in the king. This is very prominent in the Pharaonic tradition of Egypt, but in early Mesopotamia, it is also present. The king is the deity. Not only that, but everyone in his court is symbolically related to that king. Now, it is at this time, the date is about 3500 BC, that the five visible planets were discovered in the heavens. These five little points of light moving in mathematically calculable traces through the fixed stars. And it is at this time that the priest caste, discovering this, conceived the idea that there was a heavenly cosmic order that should be duplicated in the social order. And we have a pantomime, a courtly pantomime of the heaven, of the order of the heavens. It is at this time that the symbology of the crown, the solar crown, and the lunar crown with the horns of the moon comes along. The king and court represent this heavenly order. In the old Sumerian city of Ur, an archaeological site has multiple graves in which 64 human beings had been buried together, all in courtly array. And they were not people in disorderly fashion thrown into graves and covered over. They were in rows without any sign of struggle. There were mostly court people. There was a king and queen. The queen's entire court was buried with her, and the king's entire court was buried with him under her. Now, it was thought that this entire court had gone to the grave as a ritual act. This is only one instance. In every one of the ancient cultures, the Egyptian cultures, the early Chinese, we have graves with as many as 800 people buried in them. And the dynasties in the pharaohs of the first Egyptian dynasties had, in fact, two funeral estates, one in Abydos and one in Memphis, as though you had one country place and one city place with as many as 400 people buried with the king in each one of these. One must ask, where is the individual in a situation of this sort? There is no such thing. There is only this great law, which is Egyptian is called Vat, in Sumerian was called Mei, in Chinese is the Tao, and in Sanskrit is the Dharma. This is a cosmic law which comes from all eternity, permeates the world, and anyone who wishes to be a thing, who wishes rather to be something, must live in terms of this cosmic law. And there is to be no individual choice whatsoever. There is no opportunity to think, what would I like to do? What would I like to be? Your birth determines exactly what you are to do. This basic ideal of what I shall now call dharma, a virtue, of a cosmic law to which the individual must submit if he is to be anything, is fundamental to the Orient to this day. And the individual who does not participate in that is said to be asat. He is nothing. He is no thing. Whereas the one who does participate in something, sut, the Sanskrit word that has been pronounced suti, where the wife follows her husband into the grave or onto his funeral pyre, this is simply the feminine form of the role. And when we look back at those graves at Ur, there was a wife. This whole court went following the husband in death. Not only that, but those early kings were killed ritually. Every 6 years, every 8 years, every 12 years, in varying numbers, in the various traditions, the king and his court went into the ground to be dissolved and born again in the next court. Now, it is against that the Occidental, or the Levant plus Europe, ideal of the individual that must be measured. And if we look for a date for the first transformation comes along, we can take the date at about 2500 BC, a little later than that when the texts of the Mesopotamian began to distinguish between man and the god. The king is no longer the god king. The king is the servant of the god. He is called the tenant farmer of the god. The city is the god's estate, and the king is the god's servant there. It is at this point that myths begin to come along of man created by the gods to be God's servant. Man is to be the servant of the god. He is not himself a manifestation of the divinity in any sense. God and creature are apart. He is the servant of the god and the god's slave. Here's a myth that lets you see from this how these two worldviews are contrasted. The worldview of the individual who is no individual but who participates in a divine essence, and the Western idea of the individual who is separated from the god, and show how they stand in contrast. In one of the great India sacred writings, the Brihadaranya Upanishad, which dates from 700 BC, there is the story of the creation of the world. And it goes as follows. In the beginning, there was only the self, and the self said to itself, I am. And as soon as it said, I am, it had the concept I, ahang in Sanskrit, ego. As soon as it thought it, I, it became afraid. Then it reasoned and thought of whom should I be afraid since there is no one but myself? By this reasoning, fear was eliminated. No sooner was fear eliminated, this being thought, I wish there were another. Now this being was as big as a man and a woman embracing, and it became a man and it became a man and a woman embracing, and then embraced and begot men. And then the woman thought, how can he embrace me when I am of his substance? And she turned into a cow. And he turned into a bull, and they begot cattle. And this whole thing went down the line to the ants. So all beings were created and poured forth. The Sanskrit word is sushti, poured forth. Creation is a pouring forth of this original being who split in two and became the world. And he looked around and said, I verily am this. It is all I that has become the world. Now, you remember the counterpart in Genesis? Do you remember a certain gentleman who was split in half, his name Adam to wit, and Eve was drawn from his rib? Adam was split in half, and one part became Eve, and we are all his progeny. But please notice in this case, God split Adam apart. You have God and man. God did not become creation. The God is apart from a creation. Man and God are not the same. Creature and created are different from each other. These are two totally different interpretations of the same symbol. Of the split being that became two and then became all things. Now, I want to point to the main ideal for the individual in the great traditions of the Orient. The main ideal is that you should realize is that you are a manifestation of that great being. That is what you are. It is to be a discovery, a recognition of identity. In the West, the main ideal is that you should discover a relationship to that being, not an identity. This is quite a different religious notion. The great symbol for the Oriental realization is the figure of the Buddha. The story of the Buddha's realization of the Buddha is extremely illuminating in its psychological nature. The Buddha was seeking to know what the truth of truth is. And after discussions with many sages and so forth, he finally rejects everything he's heard and goes himself to what is called the Tree of Illumination, the Bodhi Tree, which is the immovable spot in the middle of the world. As he was seated, the very being who in the first story, namely the creator of the world, came against the Buddha. The one who said, I. The one who said, I am afraid. The one who said, I desire. It says two things. I fear. I desire. This is the old Oriental concept. So this being came against the Buddha, first in the form of I desire, and he paraded before the Buddha his three beautiful daughters. And if the Buddha had thought I, he would have thought they. He had no I. He saw no they. The temptation failed. The great being then turned himself into a monster of terror and hurled at the Buddha an army. And if the Buddha had thought I, he would have thought they. He would have felt fear. The army failed, and as their weapons reached him, they turned into flowers, and he was filled with bouquets of flower. Because he had neither I nor the desire and the fear to go with that, he had, as it were, pushed himself back of creation. He had uncreated the world. He had gone back of that desire system of which the world is created. Now, it is this I that the Orient seeks to eliminate. It identifies the I with what Freud calls the pleasure principle. Pleasure principle. Just the drive for desires. Okay? In the West, we have a totally different notion of the I. Those who have read Freud have learned of the id desires and fears. The id is the innocent dynamism of the uneducated primitive psyche, and is exactly as depicted in the Indian myth. But the Freudian ego is not id. The ego is a function in the psyche that is oriented to empirical reality. It is a function of the psyche that is to realize the unique occasion of I who was not here before, meeting this situation that's never existed before, performing with a sense of personal responsibility on this occasion in relationship to what Freud calls the reality principle. This is what I want to stress. In our conception, there is a function in the psyche that is to be disassociated from mere primitive pleasure drive and related to reality here and now. In the Orient system, there are only two great drives, I want and you must. You must obey the rules and balance your wish system against that until you are brave enough, as the Buddha was, to quench all those wishes. It is because the Orient has this fundamental concept of ego being a negative power, as being something that ought to be eliminated, that all our talk of the individual and so forth sounds east of Iran as though it was sheer materialistic desire talking. Whereas that is not what it is. Our concept is the development of an individual. Now let me move west of the Orient. The Orient has its problem relating to this, what I would call the compatibly primitive concept of the psyche to the problems of a contemporary world, The problem there is primarily now to assimilate the machine without assimilating ego. To create, so to say, an Asian machine age where there will be no egos, where everyone would be doing what they are told to do from the great auditorium, not exactly of heaven, but what Nietzsche called the new idol, the state. This is the new God who will tell the individual what his karma and dharma are. In the West, principally, we have another notion. Now let me turn to the problem of the Western power, the relationship between man and God. And the primary problem of the individual as we conceive it here. I like to take as the most vivid example of the problem of the individual in the Levantine tradition, which is the tradition of the Near East from which our religions come, the case of Job. Here is a man who has been unjustly assaulted by his God. The text itself says, a just man unjustly harmed by his God. Justice is a human value. It is not a value of the universe. It is not a value of that id. It is not a value of the cosmic order. The cosmic order is that order of mathematical laws. Justice is a human value. Love is a human value, and mercy is a human value. These do not exist in the universe, and they did not exist in Job's God. Job experienced the impact of that tremendous mystery of being in full force, which had no regard whatsoever for his community's concept of justice. And imagine if human values should apply to God. Job was challenged when his comforters came and said, "You must have misbehaved, otherwise this would not have befallen you." He said, "No, I have not misbehaved. And I will not say this has befallen me because I've been untrue to my God. I have been true to him, and this has happened." Because of this challenge, God was forced to reveal himself. And what did God say? Did God say, "I'm sorry"? Did God say, "I shouldn't have done it"? Did God say, "Hey, the devil made a bet with me, and I did the best I could to win"? No. God said, "Did you create Leviathan? Could you catch him on a hook? Could you fill his head with harpoons? I did." In other words, he said, "I am great." And that was the answer. And Job was convinced. And Job, you might say, abandoned his loyalty to human values. And Job said, "I have heard of you with my ears. I have now seen of you with my eyes. I cover my head with ashes. I am ashamed." This, in the dialogue between the God principle and the man principle, shows the victory of God. And this, I would say, is the basic thesis of the Levant. Who is man alone that God should think of him at all? Obey. The sacred book revealed tells you what to do. The relationship problem is solved in terms of acquiescence of the human to the divine. This is the great heroism of the religious man. In contrast to him, I would take my symbol of the European idealist as Aeschylus's Prometheus, who was also tormented by a god unjustly. Zeus had him pinned to a stone with an iron peg on a mountain and sent an eagle to eat his liver. And the liver grew back every night, so it was always there to be eaten the next day, and this endless, hideous torment was imposed upon him by Zeus. Why? Because he had stolen the heavenly fire for man. He had done exactly what the people who built the Tower of Babel were trying to do. They were trying to storm heaven and to get for man the values of a human civilization. And there's that fabulous line of Aeschylus, which is in diametric contrast to Job. Job, who was man, said, "I submit." Remember Prometheus's words? When an emissary from Zeus said, "Just say you're sorry, and he'll let you go." Prometheus said, "I care less than nothing for Zeus. Let him do what he likes." Meaning, I am not going to renege on the human system of values. These are what I stand for. These are what I represent. These are what I would say what the Greek represent. And these are what I would say all the inheritors of that great Greek world represent. And these are not the same values as those represented by Job. And now we come to the agony of the Western psyche with these two systems of ideals. One preaching the beauty and majesty of the religious submission before God. The other, the hero of the humane or humanistic insistence on the values of man. These are in collision to distinctly slow in the Christian tradition, I would say more than the others. The figure of Christ on the cross himself is precisely a Promethean figure, is precisely Job figure, and he has got for man from God redemption. The Christian thesis is that man sinned, disobeyed, was rejected from the garden, and is by Christ's death and suffering, Promethean deed, returned to God's grace. Just as Prometheus sees for man the fire of civilization, Christ seizes the fire of redemption and is crucified for it by God. Consider, however, what happens in the Christian reading of the story. Christ is God who has come down to do this, and we are not God. The Indian story I spoke of earlier, all of us are that being. We are all divine. The divine power is imminent in us all. And what the God incarnate represents is our own very being. In that sense, we are all Christ's crucified. That being, which is our own very life, and which, as it were, inhibited in its manifestations through our own limitations, that is the Christ crucifies, this is the standpoint of the Gnostic tradition. You can read in the Thomas Gospel, "Split the stick and there am I," says Jesus. Christ sleeps in the stone. Throw off the crucifix of Christ, and he is what you are trying to discover in yourself. This is as a Promethean view of man mixed with the Job view of God, and is perhaps the best synthesizing symbol we have, that each individual in his own way, so to say, be a carnation. At once, the limitation and the possibility of this divine revelation, the highest manifestation, which is you, the individual. Schopenhauer thought this out in his wonderful philosophy. Every individual is the entire divinity of the world in his own way. This is a kind of synthesizing symbol to point out the divinity of the individual and at the same time to emphasize the human value systems he represents.